mental health care is still sometimes in the shadows. So what better way to bring it out than with a friendly, upbeat name like Happify Health? The company seems ideally suited to these troubling times. Connecting mental health and physical well-being? Check. Digital health? Check. AI-powered intelligent healing platform? Check. No wonder today's guest, Chief Medical Officer Dr. Murray Zucker, is so upbeat as he discusses his own journey from Penn to Rochester to UCLA to private practice and Indian reservation health plans, digital startups, and now Happify. And when it comes to suggesting books for listeners to read, he's got not just one or two, but four strong recommendations. I'm David Williams, host of the Health Biz Podcast and president of Health Business Group. Enjoy the show. Well, Dr. Murray Zucker, Chief Medical Officer of Happify Health, welcome to the Health Biz Podcast.
Thank you, David. Good to be here.
You know, when you have a company named Happify, it sort of sets the expectation that it's going to be a joyous podcast. Mine are always joyous, but especially so today, I think.
You know, they chose the name on purpose because mental health had a stigma involved, and they wanted to break through that and get out to the general public, and not only the people who were symptomatic, but, you know, helping people improve their resilience, lessen their stress, depression, anxiety. So I think the name is great, and it really says a lot.
That makes good sense. Yeah, you see, some of these names are like sort of very technical or very medical or scientific, and you're wondering, like, what the heck were they thinking? And sometimes they could explain it to you, and it's like, I guess that makes sense in an academic sort of way, but it doesn't make you smile or lift a stigma in any way. So we'll talk about Happify in a few minutes, but I want to start with how you got there, because clearly you've done a lot before that. And love to hear just a little bit about your upbringing, you know, any childhood influences that have stuck with you along the way.
Well, being a psychiatrist, I would say that's a great question, and that's one I always ask when I'm seeing patients, so thank you for that. You know, so in thinking about that, I look back and I realize I've been very fortunate and very blessed in a way. I grew up at a time and an environment that everything was popping. You know, science was popping, the brain was becoming, you know, clear how it functioned, humanities and all. So I was very fortunate. And then as an undergraduate at Penn, I had combined both humanities and science studies. And so I was always interested in how those connect. Then I was fortunate to go to University of Rochester Medical School, which was just terrific because really the person who founded the biopsychosocial model, and that means taking everything, the physical, the emotional, and the social, and putting it all together in terms of who you're dealing with and treating the person from that holistic standpoint, was George Engel, the father of it all. And he was our professor. It was like, oh my God, you know, there I was, you know, looking up at the guru. And that's really set the course for my career. For the future, sort of integrating medical and behavioral, how the brain works, physical, as well as being humanistic in approach to people. And then fortunate enough to train at UCLA, where again, the intersection of medical and behavioral was really emphasized. And so that became my passion. You know, how do you help people who are medically ill and having emotional aspects of that? And how do you help people with mental health problems and realize that it's a brain physiology problem and a psychodynamic problem all wrapped up into one? And that's an art form. So I felt very, very lucky. And then I went on to do a number of things. I was on faculty at UCLA, had a large group practice, headed the Department of Psychiatry at a UCLA-affiliated hospital, and then was fortunate enough to head TRICARE for the Western United States from the behavioral aspect, and got to see a government program at work that had a generous benefit, who really emphasized getting people healthier and medically ill people getting psychiatric help as well. So that was a real blessing. Then went on for many, many years as senior medical director at Optum Behavioral Health, where, again, I oversaw a network of a lot of physicians, hospitals, oversaw the quality and outcomes of millions of people. So rather than one patient at a time in my office, I was able to affect millions of people. That was kind of grandiose and exciting. Then after that, went on to do consulting in the private world and was chief medical officer at a digital health company that emphasized substance abuse, and then dream come true at Happify. So it's really been the culmination of my journey. And I couldn't have asked for anything better, because here now with Happify Digital Therapeutics, you're able to affect large numbers of people, improve the access, improve the quality, and using innovation, and in the palm of your hand, but in a phone, actually affect change in terms of depression, anxiety, lifestyle. So I'm very lucky.
That's it in a nutshell, huh? We could close up right here. So I guess the thing is, you know, you want to grow up at the right time.
That's it.
And then go to the right schools, and then make sure that you also happen to have like the greatest faculty at that time, and so on. You know, I know about Penn. I know about Rochester. I'm actually on board of the company up there. Spent a lot of time there. We'll talk about that later. And UCLA. Now, one of the organizations that you mentioned is actually a very big one that most people don't know much about. And let's talk about it. So that's TRICARE. So I would say that very few people know what it is, even within healthcare, and yet it's pretty big. So just step back and just say, what is TRICARE? And then as it relates to what you were doing there as well, just love to chat about that for a minute.
So that's a good point. It really is not that popularly known, but it is very, very big and very important. Essentially, TRICARE is the healthcare benefit for military retirees and the families of active duty. So when you look at all the people in the military, and it covers their families. So they're out there in Afghanistan or whatever, and their families are back home, and that's a very high-risk population because of the dislocation, the communication, and all that. And the government really wants to be sure that they get good health care. So the wonderful thing about TRICARE, and I love, you know, dealing with it, because the Congress mandates a very large package of benefits and emphasizes quality and outcome. So what better position to be in than to manage, you know, something that way rather than be restrictive or be a gatekeeper? So it covers lots of people with a great benefit, and it's nice to see that our government really cares about active duty and their families and retirees.
It's interesting, you know, we talk about comparing the U.S. healthcare system with other countries. And you think the U.S. has a so-called free market healthcare system, there's a socialized or single payer systems elsewhere. But because of the size and the scale and the complexity of the U.S. healthcare system, we have single payer systems like the VA and like TRICARE that are actually bigger than most countries. So we actually do have it here. And there's actually a lot of people that are exposed to single payer in a sense, even if they don't think about it that way.
So I learned my lesson about single payer. I forgot to mention that one of the interesting things that I've done, for 2 years I was in the Indian Health Service and ran a medical clinic on an Indian reservation in New Mexico. And that was essentially single payer, because all the medical needs as well as vet needs for their animals were covered by the government. So it was really cradle to grave care, medication, procedures, anything you wanted, no questions asked. And to serve in that capacity was a tremendous insight.
So my brother was chief of staff at the Northern Navajo Medical Center in Shiprock. Maybe you ran into one another. I don't know. And what was interesting there was you had this kind of single payer. I think he was known as the helicopter guy, because when someone was failing, they would send them off to Albuquerque, I think, before they were, you know, before it was too late. But it was interesting also this concept where somebody was getting something for free, you know, which is by treaty. And of course, a lot was given up in order to get there. But sometimes there was this notion that like the real doctors are like in Farmington, you know, because you have to pay when you go there. Now, if you look at the qualifications of the people that were in Shiprock, some of them were earlier in their career, but, you know, very top end kind of people. I know my brother trained at the Brigham, and it was typical, actually, as you probably know. But there was an interesting dynamic there as well in the Indian Health Service.
Wow, I have stories to tell about that sometime, but it's very true. You know, one of the things I learned is you have to be culturally sensitive. And whatever their bias is, whatever their history was, you really have to understand it to be effective. Because if you just come in, you know, I was coming right out of UCLA and, you know, I knew everything. And you really have to be sensitive at what the culture is, what the belief system is, because it's true. They prefer to go to the hospital down the road in a little town, I forget the name of it, but anyway, because it was private and they had, why? Because they had color TVs, and in those days, color TVs were new. Rather than be treated at the clinic or go to the Indian hospital in Albuquerque, which had much better physicians and care.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah. All right, so Happify. I took you away from that. So, I mean, what is the need
that Happify is addressing? Why does it exist in the first place?
Yeah, so why does the world need Happify? So, you know, I think the world needs Happify more than ever right now, obviously, with the pandemic, with, you know, the political situation, wars and global warming. People are incredibly anxious, and that's just in general. Then you take the population who are suffering from mental illnesses and given this external existential stress. So their symptoms are worse and the numbers are increasing. So we're in a pandemic of mental health, obviously, and there's not enough providers. There's not enough service to go around. And then you have to take a look at what's the quality and outcome of the service that is available. So in comes digital, the digital age, innovation, and takes these things like different types of therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, positive psychology, different aspects of therapy. And if you digitize them and then wrap them around in a gamification format, you've solved a lot of problems. It's a real breakthrough, I think, because first of all, you can get to a lot more people. The trick with digital is to keep people engaged because, oh, this is cute. You download an app and 2 days later you forget about it. So how do you keep them engaged in a therapeutic interaction? So you do that by gamification. So at Happify, we've got incredible engagement numbers because of the reducing the stigma, introducing gamification, making it fun and engaging rather than some laborious chore where you go into a therapist once a week. You take the digital innovation age and you bring it to the need in the market, and the outcomes are really kind of astounding in that you have a reduction in depression, a reduction in anxiety, a reduction in stress, an increase in resilience. I mean, these things are really proven by scientific studies and then repeated in journals. So that, in a nutshell, that's the digital age comes to the reality of what we're dealing with.
So, you know, you talk about this pandemic of mental health, which for sure is out there. I'm shocked when I see the numbers, and I have a hard time understanding them. But if I look at someone who's like a college age student and you see, you know, what percent are expressing anxiety and so on, and the numbers are very, very high, like 40%, or you'll tell me what the numbers are. But, you know, just it's like almost the norm. And then on the one hand, you know, you used to have stigma. Maybe there's still stigma, but the stigma was much more you know, present in my day. And now you don't have that. So you have maybe an explosion of need. And then without having the stigma, you know, it also kind of opens the floodgates for what the demand is. And there's not that many you know, professionals that are out there to be able to address it. And then things like climate change, I was hearing about a new, you know, climate anxiety disorder or something like that, which I don't know if that's a disorder, that's just a thinking person. So how do you, I mean, how do you sort through this? I mean, if most people have I don't know if you characterize this as an abnormality, but, you know, most people are in the category of having a mental illness of some kind. How do we actually think about that?
So what we're saying is now there's even a larger span of people with concerns that are uncomfortable, that are interfering with their function in their lives. And then you also have digital, which offers you the ability to personalize the approach, because you use AI and you can really figure out what that person needs, what language they speak, or how they feel, how they think. And then you can customize the approach that you're serving up in the digital format to meet their needs. Because at the end of the day, you're not going to really follow through on anything if it doesn't address what your personal needs are. So you've got this wide expanse of need, population, highly anxious. Some of them had mental health issues before, but now, let's say, to quote a fact about the tsunami of mental health stress, is that for teenagers now, it turns out that over 50% of teenagers, because of through the pandemic, have entertained suicidal thoughts. That's outrageous. That's more than double previously. And how are you going to address that? There aren't enough therapists, and everybody's, you know, at home, you know, during the pandemic anyway. But now you really can, just with their phone, have some access to help. So that makes a big difference.
You know, one of the things that I have heard, you know, back in the day, we used to have these scare discussions from, you know, people about drug use. And we had our own scare discussion in my house because my father's faculty advisor was Timothy Leary. And again, and that's another story. But so it was like not really rebellion against your parents, you know, to get involved in that. But something that I'd heard more recently from somebody who counsels teenagers was that you had a lot of people using cannabis in particular to relieve anxiety, depression, stress, and this kind of a thing. And it, you know, it seemed like a good approach at first, and then eventually you run into a use disorder from that. And it actually changed my view a little bit about kind of prescription medication for anxiety and depression, which is also seems like there's a lot of prescribing there. Now, what you're talking about, you know, from a kind of a digital therapeutic standpoint, how does that fit in, you know, to these other sorts of both licit and illicit approaches that are, you know, that are being applied?
Well, that on a number of levels, that's really important. First of all, if somebody has a substance use disorder, that really should be diagnosed, addressed, and then through digital, you can address that as well and or go into a program. But during the pandemic, it was hard to go into programs, right? So there was a big uptake in digital therapy in the substance use area. But I think the key here is assessment and triage. Because if someone's struggling with something, let's say someone's really high, a college student, highly anxious, and they're using marijuana to deal with it, and they're getting worse and worse and worse, having panic attacks and more depressed. Well, they can do screeners and assessments in a digital format, which will then personalize the approach and say, okay, these are your issues, and these are the recommendations. And then one of the things at Happify's got a number of different assets, and some of it's digital therapeutics, which I've mentioned. But another one is a digital highway, a connection highway. So once someone is assessed and then triaged, you send them on the highway to where they belong, to a substance abuse program, to a psychiatrist for medication, for group therapy or coaching. And it's all done by AI and assessment. So you get to the right place at the right time, and you push a button, and it's seamless. And then there's an appointment made, rather than, you know, this thing called three people on the back of your card, and it takes months to see a psychiatrist.
Yeah, so, you have to call 20, actually, and you get really? Two or three people to call you back. I think it's more, I've seen the lists of, when you look at these referral, if you ask for a referral, you'll get a list of 20. And they're like, well, which one's good? You got to call them all to see who's taking patients, you know. And then you wonder if that's the one person with an appointment, what's wrong with them, you know? And in any case, yeah.
That's the problem. Well, because in your health plan, they have big, I know, I used to be there, the big directories of providers, psychiatrists. We have 5,000 psychiatrists in California. Terrific. All right. But then when you really start to call, well, we don't take those patients, so you wait 3 months, the fees are too low, and then, you know, half of them are dead and the other half are in jail. So you don't really have a quality group.
Yeah.
But if you've curated the network and have a digital highway, then you're not going to get some random person. First of all, the referral is going to be matched by age, preference, cultural background, whatever. So you have much better fit. And then you click on a button and get the appointment within 24 hours, 48 hours. So it's a really new day out there when you add digital to the whole mix.
Nice. So I think you pretty much answered my next question, which is about the meaning of precision care at scale, which is something that Happify talks about. And I think, you know, just to recap on that one, it sounds like, you know, by using, digital tools, this highway, AI, and so on, you can actually get people at an individualized level, but a lot of them. It's not just, hey, Dr. Zucker's available to see you now, and it'll do a comprehensive assessment there. Have I got that right, or there's some other elements of it as well?
And again, the stages would be the assessment aspect, then you triage them. And then there are other aspects of our program. You may have come in through another digital door, let's say. Another thing we have are a digital community for multiple sclerosis, psoriasis, pregnancy, menopause, and a few others. So if you're in one of those support groups, digital support platforms, and then you have a higher need, you're already in the system. So then you go to the assessment triage function. And then let's say you're diagnosed with, wow, you really have major depressive disorder and a concurrent substance use disorder. And we already have essentially a digital medical record called LifeGraph Variable that's collecting information from your digital platform support group answers to questions, your assessment, and then through AI, you're able to personalize that referral. So you go to a referral, not, you know, knock on a door for 20 people and then not there, but you can click and get the appointment the next day. So that's precision care, precision in that you get the right care, the right time, in the way you want it. Now, personal choice is also important here. It's one thing to say, all right, we've analyzed you, the digital formula comes up and says, you need XYZ, go do it. Well, no one likes to be told what to do, and you may have a choice. They say, hey, wait a minute, I don't want to go see a therapist. I don't want to deal with it, even if it's on Zoom. I just want to get some goals met. I want to try coaching. And so it's patient-centric. Precision care has to be also patient-centric. And you're directed towards, where the best care is and given what your preferences are. Now, the other trick is, if somebody tells me, hey, I think you need a psychiatrist, well, I might be offended by it, or I may feel, hey, no, I just want meds. Just give me a prescription. Forget all this other stuff. And if that recommendation is paired with an educational piece, this is why we think this. We'd like your input. And this is the statistics. Most people benefited from a trial of XYZ before they went to ABC. And it makes such a difference in people's compliance and adherence to the recommendations.
So it sounds like there's been, it's well thought out. It's appropriate for the times that we're in. It's too bad that we're in these times, but at least we have Happify there. What are some of the challenges and limitations of the approach? And, how do you think about addressing those going forward? Because I'm sure while it's a Happify, it's not like a Perfectify or something like that. I'm sure we're not all the way to perfection.
Well, that's a good name for our next product.
Good.
Actually, thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, so what are some of the challenges? One is engagement, like I mentioned. It's great to have the best product, guaranteed to make you feel better, 25% improvement in your depression, terrific. But if you're not engaged, you're not going to benefit from it. So a challenge is engagement. And again, it's got to be appealing. It's got to be at your educational level. It's got to be personalized. So there's a lot of barriers to that. And then there's also something in the field of psychology called readiness for change. I may say I want to become this and that or deal with my drug habit, whatever, but am I ready for change? And then there are stages of readiness for change. You build that into your assessment, and then you know where the person is. So they may be asking for, I want to be perfect, but they're still at step one. So then you feed them information and therapeutic tools to deal to get them to stage two of their readiness for change. So, I think a therapist does this. I mean, a good therapist does this, but it requires a lot of training, a lot of thinking. And we did a survey, or there have been surveys done, that probably only a third of therapists out there really use best practice with their patients. They get used to doing something that works for them. They feel good about it, and nobody's looking over their shoulder. But with digital, you've got outcomes, because all of this stuff is generating data. Sort of underneath all this is an engine that's collecting data. So the data can help become more personal and more effective for the person. The data also is used internally to how to upgrade what we're doing and how to improve further. And then let's say there's a large employer or a health insurance company that we're doing this with, we can give them feedback about their population, not individuals, of course, it's private, but about their population. A large employer, let's say, and we've got a number of Fortune 50 companies working with us, we can say, you have a highly stressed workforce, or, there's a lot of substance use going on here.
Yeah.
You may want to improve your benefit or your public education on that. So it really helps the employer, the health plan, and the individual.
So it's interesting what you say about engagement, because it's always it's a challenge, I think, with patients in general. And then on the digital side, there's so many apps that are downloaded once and then never used, or used once or twice. It strikes me that in the digital realm, some of the companies that are the most successful don't have an engagement problem. They're very good at it. So if we look at like Facebook or some of the companies that that have games, the problem could almost be people are just completely obsessed and addicted. And I don't know whether, when you talk about gamification, whether the goal is to have somebody so that they're touching their phone 2,000 times a day in order to use, which I read people do that, I guess, which people do in order to stay engaged with their health. Or like, is there any concern about that? Or is it the same phenomenon? How do you think about that?
Well, it's kind of maybe analogous to drugs. Now, there's medication that hopefully is prescribed for the right reason and it's good for you in the right circumstance. And then there are drugs that are bad for you. So if you look at interface with digital and Facebook addiction, let's say, that's really not good. You know, people are glued to their screens and they're going like this all the time. That's terrible for, you know, kids and teenagers for the development of their brain.
Yeah.
And it's preoccupying and not great for your mental health in general. So you don't want to be there and make it an addiction. However, to address the engagement issue and make it sticky, you want to use some of those techniques, not exactly to get them addicted, but to get them to like it. So it doesn't they don't become dependent on it. We're not going there. But you know, the founders of the company, actually previous to this, they were in the gaming industry and they were very successful and they understood what it was like to get people engaged and maybe addicted. And then they decided, you know what? Okay, that's enough of that. Let's use these principles for a positive way in terms of improving people's health care. So that's why the destigmatization and the gamification of these techniques came in.
Very nice. So let me turn it away from the professional again, back to the personal, and ask you if you had a chance to do any reading recently, and if there's any books that you would recommend, or conversely, any books you recommend that you stay away from.
Well, so I have three in mind, actually.
Yeah.
And the first one I'm in the middle of, and I'm talking about it all the time and mentioning it to everybody, and it's Eric Topol's Deep Medicine. And it's essentially taking AI, the principles of AI, and I love the basis of the book. He says, with AI and innovation and digitalization, we can put the care back into healthcare. And so because everyone's afraid, oh, AI is going to take over the world, and we can all be slaves to AI and stuff like that. That is a danger to think about.
Yeah.
But he paints it in a positive regard that actually it'll free up the physician to be able to be more human. There's stuff that AI can do that I could never do. The physician can never. I don't know all the data and all the sets and all that kind of stuff. But it can free me up to be more personal and really get to that dimension of the interpersonal aspect, which is probably the most important part of healing relationship. So that's a big book I would recommend. The next one is fairly recent, and it's Tom Insel's Our Path from Mental Illness to Mental Health. And I think that is a game changer. Tom Insel is a very well-known psychiatrist leader. He was head of NIMH for many, many years and really a spokesperson for mental health on an international stage. And aside from being a wonderful person and a great author and researcher, his point is so important. We've been talking about mental illness, NIMH, mental illness. And he said we really have to start talking about prevention and mental health and take a look at the societal factors that are causing some of these problems, the social determinants of health, for instance, and be more humanistic. And it's so refreshing to hear such a figure really make this point on a big stage. So that's a book I highly recommend. Just came out, I think, in February. The other one is a small book. Oh, I thought I had it on my desk. It's Kevin Perreau's It Takes a Village. And it's, again, about new innovations in healthcare, and the reason I'm mentioning it because Happify is one of the chapters. So
got it. Yeah, you got to throw it. You get in trouble if you didn't mention that one. Come on.
That's right.
I had one of my interviewees who actually mentioned. I asked her about a book, and she says, "Well, I'm going to get in trouble if I don't mention my husband's book because he's an author." Blah blah blah. It had nothing to do with healthcare or anything, but I think you're on solid ground.
All right, so I'll mention my daughter's book. I Had a Miscarriage by Dr. Jessica Zucker. And it made the bestseller list and New York Times autobiography. So,
great. Well, thanks for adding that one in as well. Well, Dr. Marie Zucker, Chief Medical Officer of Happify Health and so much else, thank you so much for joining me today on the Health Biz Podcast.
Thank you, Dev. It's been wonderful.
You've been listening to the Health Biz Podcast with me, David Williams, President of Health Business Group. I conduct in-depth interviews with leaders in healthcare business and policy. If you like what you hear, go ahead and subscribe on your favorite service. While you're at it, go ahead and subscribe on your second and third favorite services as well. There's more good stuff to come, and you won't want to miss an episode. If your organization is seeking strategy consulting services in healthcare, check out our website, healthbusinessgroup.com.